finance ministers met last week to discuss the reform of the Stability Pact as proposed by the European Commission. Here at Bruegel, we were asked to contribute to this discussion by analysing the long-term fiscal needs that countries will have and how well they may be able to meet these needs. How much fiscal space do countries have? What is the fiscal adjustment that countries need to do to help bring their debt positions at levels that are safe? Is the era of low interest rates and therefore of cheap finance now over? How much will we need to invest in the future and how much of these investments will have to be met by the government? Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast series. I'm Maria Demerges, and my guests today are two of the authors of this contribution, Jeremy Zettelmeyer, Bruegel's director, and Joel Darvas, a senior fellow at Bruegel. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, if I may start with you, I mean, the purpose of the meeting last week was very much the fiscal framework and the new rules have been proposed. Is there any progress on finding agreement on these rules?
I think there's a lot of progress. So the European Commission last Wednesday came up with a legislative proposal that not simply or does not just formalize its November communication, but actually goes quite far in accommodating some of the concerns of member states, particularly Germany's concerns that the original proposal provided too much discretion for the Commission, could potentially be abused, would not be vigorous enough in reducing debt. So the Commission really tried to address some of these concerns, in essence, by proposing a set of what they call safeguards that would require minimum adjustment regardless of what the debt sustainability analysis of the Commission says. Now, maybe contrary to general perception, the informal meeting of the Economic and Financial Council of the EU, of the ECOFIN in Stockholm last week, which we attended and where we presented this paper, was not about the fiscal governance framework. So the proposal of the Commission came out only 2 days before that meeting. And so even though it was discussed on the sidelines, there were no negotiations. And we would assume that this will be discussed at the next formal meeting of the ECOFIN. Yeah. So, you know, some newspaper says member states have not agreed. Of course they haven't agreed because they haven't discussed it. So we have a very far-reaching proposal by the Commission, which in my view deserves to be taken very seriously. It is a very serious step towards the German concerns, and that will be the subject of the next ECOFIN.
Yeah. So let's then focus a little bit on the purpose of the paper, which is very much about the fiscal needs that a country has and the ability to meet these fiscal needs, right? So if I may turn to you, Zolt, and talk about the fiscal space. Explain to us what is fiscal space and how much of that do countries have?
Countries will need to achieve sustainable public debt positions. And the recent changes over the past few years can make it more difficult, quite importantly, because interest rates or real interest rates, so nominal interest rates adjusted by expected inflation, they have went up. So in the paper, we had a new measure of what is the expected real interest rates in 5 years from now. We use both, market data to extract such an information. And what we found is that compared to the period before the pandemic, these real interest rates went up quite substantially. However, before the pandemic, such rates were rather negative. And even though they increased, currently they are not really relatively high in a historical comparison. In fact, they are still continue to be quite moderate. I mean, on average, around 1% per year, which is not that high. And if you also look at, you know, interest rates always have to look at in conjunction with economic growth. The long-term 5-year ahead economic growth projections were either remain broadly the same or even slightly improved, which is quite a notable thing. So the growth interest rate differential deteriorated somewhat, which will make it more difficult for countries to reduce their public debt ratios. But nevertheless, from a historical perspective, the values are not extraordinary at this stage.
If I may go back a step and sort of talk about the starting position, which is the debt positions, right? Before we go into the conditions of reducing them. Germain, can you tell us a little bit about the debt positions of countries, where we are now, and, you know, will there be adjustments needed and how big these adjustments need?
Right. So what the paper does, like Joel started explaining, is that it looks at the drivers of fiscal adjustment needs in the future. And so people typically think of the main driver being higher debt. However, if real interest rates are really low, then you actually don't need to have a much bigger fiscal effort to finance even substantially higher debt. So in the paper, we decompose the sources of higher fiscal pressures by comparing, like Joel said, two time periods, 2019, just before the pandemic, and then today. And so we look at how everything that has happened in the middle, which is the pandemic, the extra spending needs as a result of the pandemic, the energy price shocks, the inflation, which led to monetary policy tightening and raised real interest rates. All these things, you know, prima facie go in an unfavorable direction. So we have higher debt and we have less favorable conditions for financing this debt. And if you may remember, we even thought at the time of the pandemic that the pandemic might lead to something we called scarring, which was the idea that there would be structural changes that might permanently reduce growth. And so looking at all those drivers, we find debt on average has gone up by about 10 points of GDP in the EU. And when I say it's gone up, these are the levels that are expected to remain permanently high. So again, like George said, we compare five-year projections from the perspective of 2019 and from the perspective of today. So we want to get a sense of what people, namely specifically the IMF, these are IMF projections, expect to remain from the pandemic and war experience after the dust has settled. So those debt levels have gone up by about 10 points of GDP, and at the upper quarter of the distribution in the EU, they have gone up by almost 15% of GDP. And then, as Joel said, real interest rates have gone up quite substantially. They've gone up by almost 2 percentage points. But on average, indeed, at the upper end, a bit more than that. And so this is a substantial shock. I mean, this 2% is the sort of shock that we were looking at with trepidation at the time of the pandemic. But still, the starting point was very low, negative rates. And so even today, on average, real rates that are expected in the future, so this is the expected long-term rate in 5 years, they are quite low, 1%. And then the big surprise for us was that, in fact, if anything, growth expectations have gone up. So if you put all these together, what you find is that the fiscal adjustment needs in the future, so we think of this as sort of within the next 5 years or so, have gone up by about 1% of GDP or a bit less, right? So on average, if you were in a particular at a particular primary balance, so the difference between taxes and non-interest spending, which was just stabilizing the debt in the past, then you would have to raise this primary balance through lower expenditures or higher taxes by about 0.8% of GDP in order to continue stabilizing the debt. Now, this, however, of course, is a counterfactual, which is does not capture the situation of most euro area or EU countries, because, of course, most of them already had to put in more effort to stabilize their debt, or others had a lot of fiscal space, right? So the starting positions of these countries are vastly different. So this sort of 1% fiscal adjustment need on average just tells you sort of this is what the pandemic and the war created in terms of extra pressures. It does not tell you what individual countries need to do, but that's something we also computed.
Yeah, indeed. So can we talk a little bit about sort of countries? I mean, it's difficult to talk about all countries in the EU. Yes. But can we talk about groups of countries? Maybe that's of those who have higher adjustments, of medium adjustments and lower adjustments in the context that just Jeremy just described. So, if you were, and particularly we care about those who have to make the biggest efforts, right? Those who have to have higher adjustments. What are the numbers that of adjustment for those countries that are most unfavorable positions? What are the efforts that they need to make, Zolt?
Let me start saying by our main conclusion is that even in the most highly indebted countries like Greece and Italy, substantial fiscal adjustment is needed, even beyond what these countries already planned in their stability or convergence programs. But the magnitude of the adjustment is not extraordinary in a historical perspective, meaning that these countries in the past had higher primary balances than what is required to achieve, let's say, a steady reduction in the debt ratio. I mean, in terms of numbers, we found that, let's say, for Greece and Italy, would need to have about 2.5% of GDP permanent primary surplus in order to reduce that at least 1% per year in each year over the next 3 decades. Which is a considerable, number, but not super high. I mean, during the euro area crisis after to the 2009 and 10, some countries were asked, especially Greece, were asked to achieve a much greater primary surpluses. So in terms of magnitude, it seems doable. But there are a couple of buts. I mean, first of all, we did not consider uncertainty. So what we did is a deterministic simulation of, how fiscal adjustment should continue in the future under a baseline set of assumptions. But if you look at, what happened in the past decades, unfortunately, bad news always come, which tend to increase the debt for certain reasons. So if you also incorporate uncertainty, then perhaps more is needed to keep that falling at a steady rate. And another major issue is that we are not sure whether current pressing spending priorities, especially on climate and defense, are properly included in the baseline government projections for public expenditures. But we know that, for example, to manage climate change and to reach EU climate goals, quite substantial public investment would be needed, or subsidies for the private sector to incentivize private investment in this area, which will also cost quite some money. So it's, reaching, let's say, I would say this 2.5% primary surplus is needed, but at the same time, there would need to be a change in the composition of public spending, favoring, let's say, more climate and more defense spending. Which obviously means that the other types of spending will need to be reduced as a share of total spending, and that might also prove to be a challenge.
So we've had two huge crises in the past 3 years, and you're saying that the worst countries, in terms of efforts that they have to make, still is quite doable. What accounts for that?
Yeah, so first, it's important to distinguish two dimensions of needed fiscal effort. One is the permanent primary surpluses that countries need to attain in order and maintain in order to reduce debt, right? And so here, like Jolt has said, the biggest numbers are something in the order of 2 to 2.5% of GDP, and that's true for Italy and Greece, but these are really the outliers, right? So actually the problem is less bad for almost all countries than it looks from these two numbers. So the vast majority of EU countries has debt stabilizing or debt, even debt reducing primary surpluses of in the order of 1% of GDP or less. Some even have negative, right? And that is because the debt dynamics do remain very favorable. Then the second dimension is, even though these steady state required primary balances are relatively low, we are starting from a position with very big deficits. We still have very big deficits in the EU. And as it turns out, The last available medium-term plans of countries to reduce those deficits, which are the 2022 Stability and Convergence Programs, soon to be replaced by the 2023 Stability and Convergence Programs, and we will then update our paper. These medium-term plans do not go far enough to reach even these relatively modest debt-stabilizing primary surpluses. So specifically, you know, the planned structural primary balances, according to these latest stability and convergence programs, fall short of the debt-stabilizing primary balance by more than half a point of GDP in about seven countries. And then if you look not at the debt-stabilizing primary surplus, but actually at the debt-reducing, which of course is higher, then you have 12 countries for which this statement applies. So they would have to increase their primary surpluses by at least half a point of GDP beyond what they are already planning to increase by 2025. Now, the good news, of course, is they still have time to do that. So our little counterfactual exercise assumes that you need to get to this debt-stabilizing primary surplus in the medium term. 2025 is not the medium term. That's sort of next door. They still have a few years to get there, and a half point is not very much. So if you look at, say, the numbers of countries that are 2 points of GDP away from their debt-stabilizing or debt-reducing primary surplus, that group is smaller. There may be five countries in there, but then again, as Joel says, there's uncertainty. So if you factor in uncertainty, then more countries could be in there. So we have a sort of a nuanced message. And by the way, just one to correct one thing that Joel said. Actually, Greece has in its baseline plans already what it needs. Right? Greece is actually an exception. So Italy does not. But having said that, Italy's baseline plan is probably outdated. And the IMF's World Economic Outlook projection actually project that Italy will not only reach but exceed, significantly exceed, its debt-stabilizing and even debt-reducing primary surpluses in the next 5 years. Now, whether that's realistic or not, we don't know, right? But so on both Italy and in Greece, these are countries that either have plans or have, you know, credible policy baselines, at least in the eyes of the IMF, that will get them there. So for the most part, this is kind of good news. So yes, we will need to see more fiscal effort than is currently planned in the EU, but not a whole lot. Mm. And indeed, the IMF thinks that, you know, several of these countries will do it. And then the IMF is much more skeptical on other countries like Belgium and France, where they argue they will not get anywhere near what is needed, and we will see, right? So we will also have to see once they produce their revised stability plans to what extent sort of our message and perhaps the IMF's is already internalized in those plans. But like Joel said, none of this takes into account this very high spending needs that comes from defense, that may come from climate investments, which we think for the most part is not incorporated into these fiscal baselines yet.
Yeah. So we need to talk about sort of the future in terms of investment. Is before we're there, I mean, I think the issue of uncertainty is important. You know, it's not easy to think about uncertainty. You just have to think about different scenarios. So interest rates are going up, but real interest rates are still very, very negative, I mean, given the inflation rates that we are thinking about. Joel, you started your introduction by talking a bit about the interest rate. Tell us a little bit about, you know, how countries are going to service their debts as interest rates, nominal interest rates are going up. And what is that going to mean? If those interest rates will be going to be sustainably high for the long term, what would that mean for any of the, actually, I don't think very, actually good story that you're telling, good in the sense that it's not terribly pessimistic, despite the big shocks that we've seen.
Let me start with the good news for the medium term, namely that during the past couple of years, when interest rates were very low, several countries extended the maturity of their public debts. Namely, they, for example, when interest rates were zero, they borrowed a lot for 10 years or 20 years, which means that until the existing debt matures, countries on that portion of the debt, countries will continue to pay very, very low, close to zero, in some cases even negative interest rates. So the current recently higher interest rates only influences the new borrowing that countries are actually doing, and it will take quite a long time until public debt will fully reprice, and during that period EU countries will greatly benefit from the low borrowing costs that they did in the past. And certainly we see that in the simulations that this is a very powerful impact, and for many years it keeps interest rates at a relatively low level. Now, the main issue is what will happen with interest rates in the more medium and longer term. And, you know, that's very difficult to speculate. There are also different views, like, you know, there's a Blanchard Summers well-known debate on whether interest rates will go back to the low level or stay at where they are now. And certainly we did not want to take a stand on that. I mean, factors which contributed to low interest rates in the past could return. I mean, such factors, for example, include demographic issues like, you know, longer life expectancy creates more savings. Also, a couple of emerging countries still have very large current account surpluses, and they plan to invest that into high quality assets, which lowers the nominal, at least the nominal saving rates. On the other hand, in the past, investments was relatively low, at least in advanced countries. And we know that, you know, interest rate is somehow the result of savings and investment. So if savings is high, investment is low, then the real interest rate can be low. Now, looking to the future, the situation might change. For example, China does not have a big current account surplus anymore, yet certainly this does not reflect in a big change on the global excess savings. Now, secondly, if you look at climate investment, that might require quite a lot of investment into new technologies. Also, some of the old brand technologies will need to be scrapped even before their service life ended. So investment needs might go up. There are also some indications that the labor is getting into more powerful situation. In the past, with high inequality, larger share of income went to the super rich. We'd save more. If inequality would reduce in the future, then more income would go to the middle and lower classes, which tend to save less and consume more. So there are factors suggesting that interest rates might keep at the current rate or might even increase, but it's very uncertain. So we do not want to speculate on the possible direction of interest rates. Nevertheless, we said very clearly in the paper to draw the attention of ministers that even if interest rates might go back to the previously lower level, they should not base their fiscal plans on this assumption. Instead, they should have, you know, a conservative assumption or using at least what interest rate is expected by markets on the medium term and base their fiscal projections on such assumptions.
Yeah, no, but some of the structural factors that were contributing to low interest rate, and they're quite different in the EU than they were in the US. I mean, things like the market concentration or the absence of finance in Europe, private finance, implies that, and then I'm coming to the fiscal needs in the future. You know, whatever investments need to make need to be led by the fiscal authorities, because, you know, the markets in Europe, the private markets for capital, which in my view are keeping interest rates low, are simply not there. We don't have the developed markets that we might need. And that brings me now to the question of the future in terms of what we need to finance. Jeremy, you said that it's not obvious that governments have actually taken into consideration fiscal needs of the future, either on climate or on defense. Can you talk us through the sort of the sizes of this and what they would mean, in your opinion, in terms of the fiscal efforts that we need to make? And if they were to come true, what would that mean for our fiscal positions?
So the estimates in the paper for defense spending, so we only look at defense and the climate, are quite crude. So all we do is we compare current defense outlays with the 2% of GDP NATO commitment. And of course, that has not been attained, that commitment, for a long time. So the question is, why should it be different now? The answer is Ukraine and Russia. And so, you know, if that is something we're going to take more seriously, then we are talking about increasing defense spending anywhere by between 0.5% of GDP up to maybe 1.5% of GDP. So this is quite substantial. There are very few countries, Greece, again, being one of the main exceptions that actually attain or surpass the 2% commitment. Then with respect to climate, so Jolt has contributed to this area and may want to add. So this is a little trickier because we only know for sure sort of total investment. Well, we don't know anything for sure, but it's easier to estimate total investment needs in climate, including private, than specifically public, right? But there are some estimates out there that Jolt has used saying about, you know, one third of the total may have to come for the from the public sector. And then you can look at the national plans that countries have in the EU on what do they want to do to meet the Green Deal targets. And so then you get somewhere in the order of 0.6% of GDP. And there are other...
Just to clarify, this is annually from...
Yeah, annually.
Till 2030 to get to the Green Deal.
That's right. That's right. So it's a medium-term annual requirement. And there are other sources that actually put the number a bit higher, somewhat above 1% of GDP, which we also cite in the paper. So if you add this all up, you know, you could see additional investment needs of, you know, 1% to 2% of GDP per year. And sort of that is... quite daunting and is sort of more or less in the same order of magnitude, if not higher, than what countries would have to do to stabilize the debt, right? It comes on top of that. Now, I should sort of mention one important thing, which is, so two caveats. One is, it is, of course, unclear whether it is the best to have all these investments and defense commitments necessarily happen at the national level, right? It might be a lot more efficient to do a lot, some of this at the European level. And so this brings us back into the discussion of EU public goods. Yeah. And so it is possible that, you know, we will need to find revenues for this one way or the other. But if we find revenues collectively, we may actually have to increase spending by less, because it will be more efficient than if every country does it by themselves. And then the other caveat, which we have not highlighted in the paper, but I think is still important to say, is that to the extent that we have a one-off investment push for climate in particular, so this would not be the case, I think, for spending on defense, which needs to be repeated year after year after year. But if we are talking about, you know, spending, say, 10 points of GDP on climate investment over the next 5 to 10 years, of course, this is also something that could be done simply through higher debt if we at the same time have a very credible plan to reduce the flow deficits and generate those primary surpluses that we need to stabilize the debt, right? So the primary surpluses that we need to stabilize the debt in the order of, you know, maybe 1% of GDP for most countries or a little less, if we manage to create a system, including through fiscal rules, the topic we started off with, that credibly, permanently produces those surpluses, whether you then have an extra 10 points of GDP in debt that you have taken out to finance investment in climate isn't going to break the bank. I mean, this is something one can, in fact, finance with higher debt. What one cannot do is to continue pushing up debt year after year after year in order to make these investments. But a one-time investment push could, of course, be debt-financed.
Can I add?
Yeah, of course, please, yes.
At a point, again, referring back to the new economic governance reform and the fiscal rules. Mm. So what I would like to add is that if it will be passed, then we will have much more information on all kinds of climate and other plans, because at the heart of the Commission's proposal is a so-called fiscal structural plan. And this plan does not only have to explain, you know, what, you know, the fiscal developments will be in the years to come, but they also have to explain how national spending and reforms contribute to EU goals, including climate and digital goals and the European pillar of social rights. But from the perspective of our discussion at the moment, so we have a greater clarity on how much climate-related spending governments plan to do in the next 4 to 7 years if this government's reform proposal would be adopted. And that will certainly help us also researchers to assess whether what countries plan, for example, to do for climate change, whether that is enough or whether more will be needed to meet the EU climate goals.
I think the interesting thing here is, how much do we actually need, whether it's justified to finance with debt, and whether we should, something that, Jeroen, you started talking about, whether this debt should be mutualized. Yeah, this is what you just so announced. So for some countries, the ability to rely on debt for financing those needs is easier than for others, right? And also, Isolde, you have often talked about how easy the temptation when you have to cut, you always cut on investments in the future. So, you know, the first thing to go is really your long-term plans about something that doesn't have an impact on today. And I think we all agree that the urgency for doing something on climate is there. And yet, and yet it is the first to be cut if the uncertainty materializes, right? So, Jeremy, you talked about efficiency gains to be had. I mean, these are certainly economic efficiency gains, but how easy is it to persuade others that, you know, economic efficiency gains should really be reaped? And actually what I'm talking about really is the political will to do something like that. What type of arguments would convince the political establishments of this world that this is worth pursuing?
Well, we would need to make an argument that, you know, common European objectives should be best pursued at the common European level, and that this makes sense because it makes it actually cheaper to do it. But you're right to point out that this is, you know, cheaper is a collective argument. And then the question is, how do you achieve fair burden sharing, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are two dimensions, sort of. One is that you may be able to finance public goods in the EU at the European level, which then, assuming that these goods are properly selected, so that we're actually selecting those goods that are more cheaper to supply at the European level, this would lower the fiscal cost, and that fiscal cost could then be distributed proportional to GDP, essentially, so that there would not be any transfers from the richer countries to the smaller countries. So this is one possibility. Then the question arises: what if, in the end, you know, some countries are not able to pay for this because their own fiscal constraints are more binding, and then we will have to figure out some way of, you know, spreading the burden sharing over time, or maybe, you know, coming up with another way of, you know, compensating countries by doing things that, you know, those countries that are ultimately paying the bigger share value. So that becomes essentially a political negotiation, right? But it is not clear. It is not clear at all. And, you know, but basically, based on our analysis, for the most part, I'm not sure we are going to get into that problem, that if you do things efficiently at the European level, you will actually require a transfer across countries in the way that the NGEU was a transfer. So,
well, half of the NGEU.
Half of the NGEU.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So people have in mind that this is what's ultimately driving this. I don't think so. I think it's efficiency, and then whether we will need a transfer element once we know how big the bill is a little unclear.
Why was it so easy for the Next Generation EU to be created in the pandemic, and it's not so easy for a similar type of discussion, even if it's not a similar fund, to be had given the urgency of the climate?
Well, from a both a legal and political view, the fact that these were spending needs that could be directly related to an economic disaster that was exogenous, that was not the fault of anyone, made it a lot easier. It also, I mean, not only because those that ultimately are receiving the money were innocent, right? So this is not a compensation for past fiscal sins, which is, of course, what has been be the big barrier, right, to mutualization and transfers within the EU in the past. So there was no sense that this would create moral hazard, that it would invite, fiscal profligacy in the future. But then also, and perhaps even more importantly, the fact that this was tied to the pandemic shock provided something like a guarantee or a reassurance for countries that were net financers of the package, that it would not be repeated in the future, because it's unlikely that you'll get something as big as the pandemic shock, right? The problem with EU public goods is that it removes that safeguard, right? It basically says, we now think it's okay to have common EU financing of goods on a permanent basis. And that is politically much more difficult, and it's also legally more difficult because you do not have revenue sources at the EU level to finance a public debt. You need to ask member states for money to do this. And so whether or not we succeed with EU public goods will depend a lot on whether one can identify genuine own resources, as the technical term is, and the Commission is working on that. We will also work on that in the future. But the fact is, in the near future, the fact is that we are constrained as a union by the fact that the taxation power is at the national state.
Sure. It's quite remarkable that we still haven't decided how we're going to pay back the next generation EU fund, right? And still very EU is capable of going out in the markets, borrowing at low level cost without actually explaining how we're
going to be able to pull it off again. So we won't be able to suggest new EU public goods without answering that question.
Absolutely. Result.
Well, I mean, just a technical answer to your question that, you know, member states agreed to dedicate 0.6% of their gross national income each year for servicing the debt. So in principle, if new own resources will not be found, then it will just member state contribution. So I think that was also a reason why markets also were very enthusiastic about EU bonds, that member states committed a much larger amount than what is needed for the actual repayment.
Yeah. I mean, the EU debt that was issued to finance NGEU will be repaid one way or the other, right? There will be the member states are standing behind it. However, they're not going to stand behind necessarily sort of an open-ended commitment to produce EU public goods, right? No, for that, you definitely need to solve the so-called own resources problem.
That's right. So we're coming to the end of the podcast. So let's look next 6 months. Zsolt, if I may start with you, what's in the agenda? And importantly, what kind of things would you like to see happen for this discussion to actually move forward?
I highlight two factors. One is a discussion and agreement on the EU governance reforms, including the new fiscal rules. While certainly there are a number of issues through which the proposal can be improved, but I think even in its current state, it will imply a great improvement compared to existing rules. And the second one is my main concern is it continues to be green investments. So I would like to see more clarity on how member states aim to address the mounting climate change challenges that Europe faces.
Indeed. Jeroen?
I agree with both of those. And the only one that I would add is the one I already alluded to, which is we need to make progress on the so-called own resources that the EU might be able to raise to repay its debt and possibly to repay future spending or to finance future spending at the EU level.
Great. Thank you very much both for coming today and for this. I'm sure there will be more on these issues at Bruegel and of course beyond Bruegel. And for our listeners, you can find all our writings on our webpage, www.bruegel.org. That's all we have for today. Thank you and see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.